I'm a professor of physical education at the University of Maryland, and my major area of interest really is philosophy of sport and history of sport. My love is plain everyday playing, and that's what brings me to you today. The title is What Price Glory? Kids in the Adult World of Athletics. And I've got lots of props with me. They're all on my body because I see the body as central to the freedom of play, games, contest, sport, and then, as you see in my small letters, athletics. Because I see athletics as a very small part of the total world of play, sport, games, and ultimately the kind of meaning and purpose of sport as I see it. First, I'm sort of interested in parents. How many are parents? How many of parents under 12 years of age? How about teachers? And you might be a parent and a teacher. Those are kind of the groups or youth group kinds of directors. How about coaches of any sport? How about the parents who are also coaches? Okay, I think we have a variety of them. I wore my values, in a sense, first of all, to assure you that I am in love with athletics as well as sport. What I mean by athletics is a highly organized sporting experience, which will be institutionalized in some way. Most of the youth sport, the little leagues, the bitty basketball, the Pop Warner football, some of the ice hockey in Canada, a few of the tennis groups, some of the swimming and gymnastics groups, are all what I would call athletics. That is, there is competition and winners and losers, and a league championship usually is my definition of athletics. And I see that as, at the far end of the scale, a wonderful activity for me to watch, a wonderful activity for college students to indulge in, for professionals to make us spectators if we're not too dedicated to the spectator sports. I believe high school athletics has an important role to play, both intramurals and varsity sport. And so I have worn all of my shirts that demonstrate, first of all, I'm in love with the Cubs. Yay. And I almost have to go this far back. But what this demonstrates is that I continue to back a loser. So winners and losers can't be central in my life, or I still wouldn't be a Cub fan. So I watch baseball, and I played professional softball in Chicago as a young person. I happen to be from the Washington, D.C. area, and I love football. I watch football. I think football has violence. I think football demonstrates aggression. I think football has been made the man of man sports, and that we have used football to demonstrate manliness rather than to have it as a free-rolling activity. 750,000 boys, and almost 100% of those boys are going to ruin their knees within the 4 years of high school and college in football, unless we change even more of the rules of the game. Nonetheless, I think professional football is a part of our society and has a rightful place if we would merely strike for less funds for our football players. I would be happier. I like college football. I believe in Augustana College and Morehead State and Morehead Concordia, and I believe Pacific Lutheran has won college football championships, but they have all won it below the level of what I call paid athletes in the sense of the Division I athletes. So I think we're talking about a different kind of an athletic experience. I also believe in women's athletics. Concordia College, this basketball team got its start in 1965 when I was a member of the faculty at Concordia College. I started varsity sports for women at Concordia, so I believe in varsity sport. I also believe, as you can see, in the Olympics, and I think that the Olympics has a place. I have been a member of an Olympic committee. I also have been a member of some scientific work, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit today on the role of athletics for children and the pros and cons of what has happened to children. But back in my own life, I also believe in running, and I think the marathon is a very grueling, difficult kind of experience, and I would ask that you didn't have your children running in long races in which the difference of winning and loss, winning or losing, was important to them as children. We're finding some very detrimental effects on children who have started running at six, for example, in a very serious way, the same way we have found damage to the arms and shoulder girdles, both boys and now girls, who have become pitchers too young and too concerned about that kind of an activity. But running, for the sheer joy of running, most forms of jogging, I think fit children in a very easy, relaxed sense. On Friday, I have a little sermon for you women about jogging and heavy kinds of running experiences, but I'll save that. But in the meantime, I do think the marathon is an illustration of an intramural activity. That is an activity in which the men and women and boys and girls who are running in that are not running to be the winners. They're running to finish. And that's a lot different story. If we can just think about that in youth, that they are playing to finish the game, that they are playing to enjoy the game, and that when they get home, it's not so important whether you won or whether you lost, but did you play your best? Did you pursue excellence versus did you pursue superiority and authority? It's quite different in kinds of purposes, and I think we may be teaching our kids some of the problems that they have in later life on what is winning and losing. But as I move on in my life, what I really have learned to love are the mountains. And that what we may be denying kids who have stayed at home this week because they had to finish the Little League is hiking up the Enchantments where you can fish, and believe me, they're that big, not because I've caught them, but because I've seen them. I can't catch them because I have spent my life so active that I can't get that fly in there and connect with a fish, except absolutely by chance. But when all is said and done, what I suppose I really love, and that is important, is the Holden Village kind of experience for kids. And so what I want to talk about a little with you, and separately, I have another collection. You will see that I also have, if you're losing the game, change the rules. Now, I ask you in Little League whether you ever have that opportunity. Any chance to do that for the kids in Little League? No. How about the kids out here? If you've seen, there's about 20 of them, and they're playing some kind of game. Do they change the rules? Yeah. Not necessarily in the midst of it, sometimes in the midst of it. But I'm not sure we're giving kids opportunity to change the rules. Not because they're losing the game, actually, but because the game doesn't seem to fit them. It's getting dull. They haven't selected the teams equally, or they themselves see that it's dangerous. And that's what I really love about this place, is that we can have Narnia, but the kids have as much fun in the afternoon and in the early morning when they get out on the road, if you'll let them, then they really have in this sort of organized world. Then, of course, my other t-shirt is dear to my heart, and that's Women in Sport Breaking Barriers. And for a couple minutes, I want to talk about that in relation to kids. Because girls and boys are born with the same innate physical ability, with the same loves, the same desires, eventually the same hates. And it is us as parents and as teachers that define very clearly for them pinks and blues, and that blues play and pinks watch. And it's an important concept as we're raising kids that we begin to say that blues and pinks play, and that blues can play as pinks have played, and pinks can play as blues have played.
Or and that pinks if we cheerlead.
What?
Pinks cheerlead for blues.
Oh, right. Yeah. And pinks watch, and blues have the action. And think about that, what that really means. It really means that girls have not had the experience of the joy of being successful, or even the sadness of not being successful and working it all out. This is why my vote is for sport instead of athletics for both the blues and the pinks, where they can work out a learning process in which the experience is what matters. The process of play, the process of sport, not the product. But if we say to the little boy, you may play, and you may play four doors down, but we say to the little girl, you may play in the backyard, and you may invite other little girls into play, but you may not play four doors down. We're then setting up a double standard of what is important. And even worse, as I see the issue of leftover from what I call the cult of true womanhood, the submissiveness, the paleness, the being the weak vessel versus the right of the male to sport vis-a-vis manliness, that we have set up a dichotomy that's terrible for boys who are uncoordinated, that are worse for the whole society of girls. And I thought when Title IX came around in 1972, which was that you must have physical education together, that you must have equality of opportunity, that we then could take kind of the new games attitude that girls had in their play lives and the very best of the athletics that we had for boys, and we could now put them together and we would have this wonderfully happy sisterhood, brotherhood, rolling along in all of the schools and all of the homes. Well, obviously I missed something along the way called our culture and inculcating values in our culture. And we haven't really been able to do that. But you people are able to do that within the confines of your home, your churches, and your school, by developing the attitude of the importance of movement patterns, the importance of physical activity for both boys and girls. And it becomes not only life-threatening, but very significant for the girls. What we are finding from our studies is that girls of the past, and you women of the past, who were farmers and farmers' wives, and forced into physical activity, you're not breaking your bones at 80. You don't have osteoporosis at 60. You also don't have bad knees because you didn't play football. So we've got a lot of kind of pros. But we're finding how important it is up to the age of 12, particularly, that girls are not having enough physical activity. And that in this new world, we need to equalize this activity. They are perfectly capable. You can throw them as high in the air as you want to throw the little boys high in the air. And particularly when they get in second grade, they're going to cry less, they're going to have equal or better physical ability, and you begin to play upon this for both the boys and girls, so that we don't deal with tomboys and sissies. Those are two words that really ought to leave our vocabulary. And instead, we should have the word, sophisticatedly I call it human movement phenomena. But that just means play. But play in that sort of fun way. And that it's really the adult behavior that dictates whether we really can have that play attitude, and whether girls can have all of the experiences that boys have in relation to that play motif. There's no question that play adds and helps us to learn competition, but boys and girls need that equally. It helps boys to be able to interact and interrelate. If you watch a group of boys left to their own devices, they learn to play together. And in fact, don't they choose teams pretty equally when you think about it? Think about your own lives. Did you really want uneven teams when you were kids? No, not really. You added them up, separated yourselves out, and the two best were usually captains, because then you already have one in each time, and you alternate it. Now, that's a tough life for little boys who were fat, and little boys who were not good, or little girls who wanted to play. But somehow or other, if you keep the adults away, kids work that out. And they have a way of evening up those teams, and if we train and spend more time with the little fat boy and the little fat girl, then we can prepare them to live in that world. And yet we do prepare them, I think, for winning and for losing. I'm not at all against competition. I'm against competition that the boy cries when he doesn't win. The boy cries because his father has yelled at him on the way he didn't hit the baseball, and when the mother complains to the umpire and the little boy gets embarrassed about it. Those are the kinds of behavior patterns, I think, that has ruined our sporting, a lot of our sporting experiences. And then for the men coaches who have said no to the little girls, one of the big problems, I think, we made in the 70s was to immediately put coeducational sports when boys had been separated and girls had been separated for 4 or 5 years in sport, so that boys really were far superior as 12-year-olds to girls, even if the growth spurt hadn't occurred. We put them together, we'd spent all of this time teaching them that winning was the most important thing, and then we put the boys and girls together. And obviously the boys are going to have resented it, and as I see it, almost rightly so, by how we train these kids. And so only the very best girls would roll in there. But what we haven't looked at very much is what happened to the 20% of the boys who had their maybe one inning, but they had it either early to get it over with because they had to, or they had it late and they played 3 minutes, no ball came out, fortunately, to them in the field, and they wanted to quit, and father says, you can't quit, you'll be a sissy. And so somehow we now need to have a reevaluation and a reexamination of the sporting experience so that boys and girls can learn it together. can no longer think of it as a rite of passage for males, for maleness, nor that it is a tom girl or a tomboy who must stop at 12 and suddenly is turned out into the cruel world of cheerleading. And that's kind of what we've done to the past to them. I think now that girls' athletics is here to stay. And I don't have to talk very much about it, except the realization that for boys and for girls, what's the very best learning time for kids, physically? Any ideas? It starts as soon as they can walk. It starts as soon as they can walk, you can begin to teach them things. We've now learned at the University of Maryland, we're doing studies on boys and girls the moment they learn to walk, like between 10 months. We want to get them when they're almost in the teetering stage until they are walking. We're trying to find out how they learn their patterns and what their patterns are, and if there really is a difference in male walking patterns and female walking patterns. But what we're learning is by 15 to 18 months, if we want to, we can teach them to walk backwards. Now, there's not a good reason for a kid to walk backwards. But if we want to, we can teach them to walk backwards so that we can start on skills really very early. And exercise is important. Some doctors are having babies have exercises that they're really not getting enough kicking, that we aren't giving kids space. And kids need space in order to learn large movement patterns. When we started putting children too long into these playpens, we've really inhibited their movement patterns because we've cut off what their playground is. And it's a very small playground. We're finding in apartments, that kids in apartments that aren't taken outside, and all these films you see where the nursemaids are sitting in the park with the English kids in the past, that really is an important function. Kids need the playground. They need space. Now, they also need a boundary. And I think play does give kids boundaries. They make their own boundaries outside. These kids here someplace have put boundaries on their game. And I think it is important that they have boundaries. And that's where you can have safety. You can say, these are the boundaries. And like you did, if you're in a church parking lot and you have a church window over there, then right hand hits are out. And kids learn to control it. You'll have one broken window in a summer, but that's not very expensive. Unless, of course, you're into our stained glass windows, but for kids of one, it's not really very expensive. And so we need to think about that. But it is after they are in school and starting someplace between 7, 8, and 9 that we're going to have our very best learning opportunities. But the scary thing about that is that's the very best time to ruin a kid in relation to physical activity, that they aren't going to enjoy sport particularly. And sport really is a big part of our life. It's just as detrimental that we've interfered with their music. I happen to go to school under something called the WORT, Work Study and Play System, in Gary, Indiana. And the steel mills paid the schools to keep us there so that the men could work in the mills from 8 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, and we went continuously. So we had music, art, drama, and physical education, which is where I decided to be a physical educator. But in music, I seem evidently to have this deaf ear and monotone. We had lots of visitors coming to look at our program. And I remember Miss Volk, big, plump woman, with when she directed her fat went back and forth here, saying when visitors came, John, Jim, and Joanne, don't sing, mouth it. And to this very day, if you sit next to me in the eating dining room, 99% of the time I'll mouth it. And I hardly know I'm mouthing it. I'm not really singing it. And I simply don't sing. Because for 3 years I was told, you know, obviously I was ruining the harmony, because you can imagine how bold I was in my singing. And always off tune, and so you musicians can certainly be in sympathy with it. But it was important learning for me later of what I've done to a lot of little boys. That we really are making fun of kids when it's time for them to be learning. We put them in Little League where they get 5 minutes of activity. We put them even in T-ball, in which they get up to bat once. They're waiting their turn for about 25 minutes. If there's any practice, only one kid practices at a time. They never bring enough softballs for everybody. They never have enough bats so that three people could be into this activity, or maybe four, one out in the field. Because that's not how we learn baseball. We learn baseball by putting all nine players out there and somebody fungo hits to them one at a time. And so we're wasting some of the time of these kids for learning all of the sports, all of the play. Because they can start in second grade to do a whole raft of things. And in fact, the absolutely ideal time for your kids are 9 through 12. There isn't one physical activity in sport that they can't learn between 9 and 12. You can see this in my title, What Price Glory, in the Olympians. I have a film that I've taped on What Price Glory on Olympian kids. And there's two things I kind of am interested in about it. One is how quickly they learn. And these little 8-year-old girls in gymnastics that can move their bodies in the most distorted manner and succeed in every kind of sporting experience that a gymnastic teacher wants to give her. Now the difficulty with that is, does the girl want to do this 7 hours a day from 8 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon? If any of you have been following the 88 Olympics and the gymnastics and the fight that has been occurring, this is a philosophical fight, really, between an American man and a Romanian man who believe that winning is important, but one believes girls are also human beings, and the other one believes that this is a robot that I am going to get a gold medal for. And in how they train, the difference in their training is phenomenal. And yet, both of them are paying a price for a possible glory. The American girls are taken away from their homes now, just like the East Germans and the Russian girls, who have been taken forever, since 4 or 5. We now have some fibers and test fibers that we can give to show the potential of kids. They're using that in East Germany to pick out their athletes for the future and saying, you're the chosen one, you will come and be a soccer player. You will come and be a gymnast. You will be a swimmer. And the parents say no, and they say fine, and suddenly the parents are not living in the same place that they were living. And so they're sacrificing their children to the Olympics. But we Americans are doing much the same thing with our kids, 9 through 12, 7 on, in gymnastics, in swimming, in track and field. We've got some evidence of some hockey, ice hockey players, in which the parents have decided what will be the role. We've got some tennis players in the same position. And it's the ideal time for learning. And so the film shows how much they can learn at these tender ages, and consequently how important that is. But what the film also shows is that the Americans have moved into dominance and superiority versus the pursuit of excellence. And certainly, as you can see from my shirts, I love the Olympians. And I love the concept of the pursuit of excellence. But in the process of it, I think we have to keep saying, what is the price? And even in Little League, you need to be thinking about what price do I want to pay when my best time for teaching kids in everything is 9 through 12. I think right here I have lots of examples of men and women who are crazy about hiking the mountains. And since they were little kids, the Witt kids particularly, and the Collins kids that I've watched grow up here, all of them have a reverence and a love of the outdoors. Is that by chance that these two families have this? Think of your kids if you've been coming here very long. There's a time in their life they don't like it, you know, where it doesn't quite fit them. But when they get here as kids and mingle and see all the things they can do, what you've done is expanded their horizons. That's why sport is important to me for girls and for boys, that you expand their choices. And yet our world is a world of specialization, and you see it in the Olympics. You also see girls 10 through 15 burnt out. You see some boys burnt out. I've been interviewing Olympian women from the 1920 to the 36 Olympics, and I have some horror stories of what happened to them after the Olympics. If you know any men who have been in the Olympics, particularly non-professional. And so what I'd like us to talk about now are some of the ways that we can deal with sport, still believing in sport, or some of your own either horror stories or great programs that you have that you think are helpful to kids, and that you can see your kids growing into having sport and having it meaningful, and in fact adding to their character. I think what we have done on a national level is interfered with the character development of kids. I happen to come from an institution where it is probably the saddest in the term of the basketball player who died of an overdose the day after he signed a professional contract. And that has made our whole university look at what is sport and what is the meaning of athletics, and what have we done to our black youth, to our white youth, and now, unfortunately, in which I have been a part of it, what have we done to women in relation to taking the men's world and said, we want it no matter how bad it is. And so we have it. And all of the problems that's in men's athletics is now in women's athletics.
Most of your examples have been how we as adults or society have been pushing. If anything, my major concern is our, you know, maybe I want to hold them back. I don't want the hockey player, I don't want the football player, you know, I want to channel different directions. You know, is there any helpful? We have a 4 and a 6-year-old. You know, of course, my son says he wants to be a hockey player and a football player. Those are the two things I don't want him to be.
Good.
So join the club. But how do you direct, channel, manipulate? I don't know what value words you have, but how do you help guide your children into play, sports, in a way that is most helpful and helpful for them?
One of the ways is playing together. And it's really important for you wives to be a part of the child's play throughout, that you don't just send them out with daddy. Some of you know Jan Quello. She was a student of mine for 4 years. And she threw, pardon the expression, like a girl. And so I kept telling Robert, be sure you teach your daughter how to throw. And if you've watched her, that daughter knows how to throw. But they have played together and skied together. And finding sports that you can do together is a beginning. But the other is influencing the world outside. You have to try to be doing some kinds of influences that you can get other kids to like that sort of world. And I think they need team sports. Certainly we spent thousands perhaps millions of dollars from 1880 to 1920 to get boys who were immigrant kids to learn to be Americans through the inculcating of values of team sports. So I see team sports as having a very important value, but the value is in the interaction between the kids, and if you have a coach, the role model element within the coach. Some of it, I think, is who you let coach. I've got a study here from Seattle, Washington, in fact, on trying to change coaches' behaviors so that playing was the essence instead of winning. And there were about 90 coaches willing to be a part of the study. Now remember, as soon as a coach said they'd be a part of the study, that they already have a commitment, perhaps, to sportsmanship, to behavior patterns that would be in keeping with, you know, what we would want for sport. And as a result of a three-year study and experiment, they did find that coaches made a difference, that the perception of the kids changed so that they enjoyed the play. There was no difference in winning or losing between the experimental group and the non-experimental group. But the behavior pattern changes of the coaches changed the behavior patterns of the spectators, the parents, and of the kids. And when the year was finished, that there were fewer percent, a very, very low percent of kids who said they weren't going to play the next year. And yet the book I have in the bookstore called Every Kid Can Win is an excellent example of ice hockey in Canada, where this large percentage of kids quit by the time they were 12, in this 9 to 12, and they were interviewing them for why was that. And the problem was the kid not wanting to, the pressures that they felt, and the time commitment. They then experimented with blues and reds and greens and yellow teams, in which every 20 minutes you change teams in Canada. And at first, kids dropped out like flies. And then by the third year, they had moved back in and liked the changing. The idea of changing teams was that you never knew who won because you were a blue, and then you were a green, and then you were red all the same day. And two teams played while two teams were being coached. Then they rotated in, and the other ones were being helped for fundamental skills. Kids are getting fundamental skills from the TV, and they're terrible skills. I mean, they look great on the pros, but the kids are not ready for that. Yeah.
I'm from Canada, and I have one of my best friends who, like an example of that, he ended up cracking at the pressure of under 15 when he was the third goalie on the Olympic team, and he was the top junior goalie in Canada, and he, due to his parents' pressure and letters of like scholarship from Boston College and Princeton and a few others, that he just eventually cracked under because he couldn't take it.
And I will say in defense, this last spring, my son, my 8-year-old, played softball, and it was a very positive experience, and it was very much the coach was in playing, everybody played, everybody rotated position, and no one knew what the score was, and that sort of thing. So we had a very good experience with it, because I went in real skeptical. We wanted to try it, and I thought, so there is hope, and a lot of it was the coach.
A lot more hope than I had 5 years ago.
Yeah, in response to what you're saying, the problem is that, and maybe response to your question, that we've been, I'm a coach, or I have been a coach, and both the high school level and coaching my kids in soccer and in basketball. But the problem in a lot of these programs, you'll find a good coach, but you have no control as to which coach you're going to get. It's like for my 12-year-old who played soccer in AYSO for a number of years, it pretty much worked out. He had a good coach every other year. Mm-hmm. He had a bad coach every other year also. Mm-hmm. And so it's it's frustrating. And one of the things you can do is you can really, you can coach, which can solve that problem, which is difficult. And the other thing is you really need to, depending on your area, there are sometimes options, and you have to really look into the, you know, into the program. We decided, we feel the same way you do about football. We decided we're not going to participate, and I don't know if you'll be wrong. 2 years when I sent that, I don't like football, you know, when he's in high school. We just decided we're not going to be involved in that. We tried to preach that line to him. But it is difficult because so many of the age group programs are, the competitive element is so strong because many of the coaches are going to be, they're going to be another pro coach, they're going to be Bobby Knight, and that's their role model, and that's the way they treat the kids, and it's very sad.
I'd be interested in that connection, Joanne. I'm hearing what kind of preparation coaches get in our colleges and universities, coaches for public schools and those who eventually teach in college and university levels. What kind of value system suffuses the preparation of coaches?
That's a very interesting question. I have a course called Philosophy of Sport that physical education majors have to take, and all those who want a coaching credential. And in discussing ethics, which is the only place, and this is a required course for majors, but not for coaches. But a lot of the coaches and a lot of the journalists, journalism
sports
majors,
journalists.
Take it, and it's really helpful. But we had a discussion on Little League, and the situation, they had to give situations for this big situational ethics thing. And the situation that they gave was, we happened to come into the championship of the 12-year-old division, and we're playing against the second team. The rules of the conference is that you must have played 3 innings in the game. It comes to the 7th inning, and the little boy comes up and says, "You forgot me. You haven't played me. The score is 3-3. And the kid hasn't caught a ball most of the season. You have to keep him on the team. Okay. And I say to the class, or the team leader does, what are you going to do? What do you think these coaches decided? Now, these are your future minors or coaches or journalists. It's a boy, it's women and men in the class.
You don't play them. It's more important to the group to win than it is for the one guy to play.
And what would be their rationale for having that happen?
Because these kids have played their heart out to win, and they want to win. And you got more of them than one. It's a group deal. It's a group sport, not a single sport.
The kid will feel bad.
The object behind that is what it's like for the kid, what they'll tell the kid, is it better to sit and not play and be part of a winning team than play and be part of a losing team?
That's what 3 out of the 4 groups came up with, was talk the kid into not playing. And the one group that said no had, interestingly, the captain of the football team at Maryland in the group, and he said, no, that you play the kid, and the fault is yours as the coach, if there was a fault, and you have to take the fault, and you don't point out winning or losing, but simply that everybody is playing this game, and you put everybody else in, and if you lose, that you have lost it, or we have lost it, and that the important thing is playing. The whole class said, no way. The kid will feel bad, and you simply can't do that. But one of the groups said, well, we don't really care what the kid thinks. I've worked all this time, and I want to get a job, and I want to win. And besides, we want to go down to the state and play. So that I'm not going to play that kid. It's my mistake, and next time I'll catch up. If we win, so we go down, then next time I'll let them play 2 innings the first 2.
There was an interesting frontline program on public TV this year on Japanese sports, comparing them to U.S. And if I understood it right, they play the ultimate games, the tie games. And they gave interviews of these people in baseball where you have an American over there getting paid $1 million, bases are loaded, they're two runs ahead, so they want a couple more insurance runs. They pull the number one player out and put in a pitch hitter because they don't want to get too far ahead. The goal in Japanese athletics, supposedly, according to the Frontline article, was to play for a tie. That's the ultimate win-win situation.
Even in baseball?
I mean, is that? And that was in baseball, yeah. It was just boggled my mind. And then they compared and contrasted that to the way they do business. And how different that is. But in sports.
So your losing team doesn't have to lose face. That's
right. Saving face is the important Japanese principle. There's the save face. So a one run game is okay. You know, tie is better.
Better than a 5-run blowout.
Oh, yeah, you never do that. That's totally irresponsible.
There's some hope. I think where I come from, where it's just a rabid soccer fever in the town. In fact, nobody plays Little League anymore.
Where is that?
At least more exercise.
Ena, Wisconsin. And there's just a ruling that's come down from the national body, and I can't remember what they're called, but they've decided that they're no longer going to have competitive leagues. These select teams that only the best players get on, and they travel to all the tournaments. It used to be when you got to be 10 years old, you had to make a decision whether you were going to play for fun or you were going to play for blood. And now they've decided that they're not going to do that anymore. Under 12, and they're going to make the field smaller, and everybody's got to play. And I'm having had a kid who was in the situation that you just named. He was asked to be on a select team, but not quite good enough. So he sat out the whole year. And I'm happy to see some national organization starting to hear what we're saying and to cut down on that winning at all costs kind of thing.
That's great. I'm not sure if it's everybody else's experience, and this kind of sounds like they sort of reached a turnaround point where you were. I think in our experience in both soccer and basketball that the shorter amount of time that the organization has been in existence, the more likelihood there is of their values being closer to what ours are. In other words, the longer they've been around, it seems like the parents are more rabid, the trophies get bigger, because every year they want to improve the program and make it bigger and better. So in soccer, in AYSO, there's about 1,000 kids in it in our area, and it's been around I don't know how long, but to us it's too organized. It already has championships, it has traveling teams, it has all-star teams, it has the huge trophies, it has a budget. You can't, you know, when you see how much they spend on trophies, you just want to gag. But if you find the programs that have not been organized so long, they seem to be closer to what we are comfortable with in terms of values. I don't know if that's true other places.
What is AYSO?
American Youth Soccer Organization.
Yeah, I think part of that problem is with the Olympic training program as well. It maybe has been around too long. My daughter was in synchronized swimming for 6 years up in Alberta, which is the home of the world champion so far. The competition is very heavy. Kathy was in a recreational program for about 4 years, which they swam 3 times a week, and they learned the skills, and they sort of had fun doing it. And the championships and the competitions they had were very localized. She was earmarked as the coaches come down from the competitive level to watch the younger girls at the recreational level, and then the earmark ones they think are ready to move into the competitive program. And there's a tremendous amount of politics involved, because what happens is if your club has a certain number of swimmers that win medals in local competitions, then you get more funding from the provincial body, which in turn, if you have your champions coming up, gets more funding from the national body. That whole thing works out. Kathy moved up into that pre-Olympic program, and at the age of 13 was swimming 26 hours a week, which meant that she was up in the morning before 5 o'clock at the pool by 4:45, swam for an hour and a half, went to school. After school, she was back at the pool at 3:30, swam to 7, came home, did her homework, went to, you know, ate her supper, did her homework, went to bed. There was, now for people who want to keep their kids off the streets, it's ideal. They have no time to do anything. By the time she moved into the second year, her skills had improved tremendously, but also the pressure had come very heavily. She had absolutely no social life. Kids stopped inviting her to parties because she could never go. It was the kind of thing where she felt extreme pressure because it was a team sport. And there are very few team sports, you know, that are that bonding for girls, where it is real. You cannot leave the team or there's a huge hole because you're practicing this routine upside down in the water for umpteen zillion months to get it perfect. And by the time February rolled around when she was 14, she had broken her wrist in the fall and had taken her training back. She was in extreme state of depression, where I was really concerned about her period. Was she going to make it through this? Because she didn't feel that life was worth living anymore. And for a 14-year-old to feel that way, there's something wrong. But she did finally make the decision at the end of the championship when her team swam to quit. And she got phone calls from coaches and things trying to encourage her to continue. But she made that choice. And I think in talking to the two silver medalists from the Los Angeles Olympics that swam, one who has became anorexic, one who went into a very deep state of depression. There's something wrong with the system that is doing that to people. And I know that they're pushing to have some kind of work and reentry. How can you reenter the world when your whole life has been at the swimming pool since the time you were 10 years old?
Or just go back to simply enjoying it as a sport.
Yeah.
How then can't step back down and just go back to enjoying it?
Well, there's some girls.
Debbie Thomas.
Yeah, there's some who have quit who have never gone back to anything. Kathy, for a while, became a couch potato when she quit. It was like her whole world had sort of collapsed. She was so used to a rigid structure that when she had the time, she didn't know what to do with it. And she decided to join the school swim team, and what was her biggest worry is that what if she was last and what if she couldn't win? And the idea was, this is for fun. This is an extracurricular activity. I mean, if you don't like it, you can quit. You don't have to feel that there's the pressure anymore. And that has been really good for her, to get in with a team where she can have fun and she can enjoy it again without feeling the pressure that, you know, she's going to let everybody down if she doesn't get a certain figure mark or do it right.
You must look at my movie sometime. It's about an hour movie, and unfortunately it's got advertisements in the middle, but it really is important. We had a suicide in an 18-year-old girl in the cross country of the NCAA track championships. I'm sure it was all over. It was an attempted suicide, and she's a paraplegic, and it was an anorexis. If any of you have female athletes between 13 and 19, I'd like to talk to you about their nutrition and their training sessions. We're finding some astonishing realization that with the lack of a period, that the hormones are changing, and we may be leading every young high elite athlete, female athlete, into a potential not only for anorexia, but osteoporosis very young. And it's just a new astonishing finding. A woman from University of Washington is working on it. And it's really frightening to me by virtue of how much I've encouraged highly trained female athletes as well as males. We've always known the problem of anemia, and at least we've known it the last decade, and the problems of the hemoglobin count. But this is a new kind of twist that we really need to deal with. Yeah.
I was just saying, to avoid a lot of these problems, I just think it's important to expose our kids to as many things as possible when they're young and a fun situation. Like you say, in play, baseball, bowling, volleyball, whatever, just so that they get an athletic feel for themselves, but just let them have fun at it and let them learn all the different sports, but maybe not, really push and have them excel in one, major sport.
Until they say, I want to do it.
Right.
Well, that's what it is.
And then you have to explore. If the kid wants to do it, do we not let the artist do it, the musician do it, the academic? And I was a very highly skilled athlete. Had I known better, I'm certain I would have been an Olympian that would have been willing to pay the price, because certainly my parents weren't encouraging sort of any kind of sport. But if you don't give them that base, it's so important that you expose them to a lot of sport, because they still can become a specialist. Don't let any of the coaches tell you, if you don't specialize by 9, you're not going to be a great athlete. I can show you men all over the world that have become great world-class athletes starting at 16. Not, of course, if they haven't been given the right nutrition and exposed to sport. You can't start a brand new individual in activity at 16, but you can make them world-class.
Well, I'm a 20-year-old who has gone through the, starting the soccer in second grade and playing everything through high school and whatever. I played volleyball, basketball, and ran track every year, and played softball, soccer, did the whole works. And the main thing for me, I think, that I'd like to tell parents is that the key that you were talking about is, let them do what they want. You were talking about later, earlier about. How I don't want them to play football, I don't want them to do this, I'm going to channel them in different areas, or I want them to play baseball. It's important to just let them do what they want. I was let to do what I wanted, and I played a lot of sports, but I never played year-round anything. I played 3 different sports in high school, and eventually, now I will be a sophomore at University of Michigan, I'm a paid athlete, I run track there, but the important thing for me, being a kid that has grown up in this society of competitive sports, has been that my parents have let me do what I wanted. They were not, they came to my meets and they came to my games, but they weren't involved. And I think the most important thing, if a kid shows, interest in one sport, they will work that out, and she quit and found something different. And that's people working things out. And, that's been my saving thing, is that if I didn't like track, I wouldn't do it. But I found that I like to do it. And, it's important to me, but it took that, and also I was at the track that Kathy Ormsby jumped off of, not at the time, but after. It's a real, we all think about it and we want to avenge that she felt as awful as that, that was a terrible thing.
And it also had a religious implication. It was not straight a sport.
Yeah, it was not,
One thing that's really like to let your kid do what he wants, there's one, one instance, the quarterback now at USC, who is considered one of the leading Heisman Trophy candidates, he has been brought up since age 4 to be a quarterback. His parents took him, his parents and his uncle took him. He has been eating, especially he's been training since age 4 to become a quarterback, and albeit he's now one of the top quarterbacks in the country, but I always wonder, maybe he wanted to do something else, but he has not been allowed. He's been told he has to play.
He wouldn't
football.
Dare drop off.
Exactly.
He's been channeled.
He's been eating specially, he's been training specially, doing special weights for him, exercises since age 4.
One pulled tendon of the Achilles.
I was really appalled one day just walking through a locker room with my brother-in-law, who was a high school coach, and he had, and I believe it came from a Fellowship of Christian Athletes, but a big poster that said, Jesus never quit. And I confronted him about it, because I think that that whole idea of being able to quit when you feel the need is really important, and to somehow have a religiosity about sport, that, you know, the more you go, the more, you know, somehow that to be a better person is really not helpful.
No pain, no gain.
Yeah.
And I think it's a mentality that we have built into sport,
mm-hmm.
that does detract from the fun. Yeah.
Would you explain a little bit about the latest research on female distance runners and the effect that it has on their periods? What does the latest research say about that?
Well, the latest research is indicating that we've always known that it has interfered with the menstrual cycle. And if the fat content of the female body gets someplace below 9%, that it is the lack of fat content that prevents the buildup for the hormones to work within the body. And we thought that this had no ultimate ill effect. We certainly know that you can have children afterwards, and that the menstrual cycle returns into normalcy. Well, what we're doing is testing Olympians of the past who are now someplace between 25 and 55 years of age, and finding a high incidence of loss of bone density and osteoporosis. And because of the physical activity that they've been in, and the rest of the female athletes, or females who have been very active, like I've been tested and I've been very active, but I was never in that so highly trained that I didn't have a menstrual cycle, and I had a lot of fat always. And so my bone density is greater than a woman of 55 ought to have, which clearly demonstrates and has that women who have been very active have less chance of osteoporosis and loss of bone density. But female athletes who had anywhere from 9 to 18 month period of not having the menstrual cycle, which probably also meant low fat in the body, had lost bone density and bone marrow, and that they were already victims of osteoporosis by 35.
What are you telling these women?
But we're just finding this out the last 18 months. I mean, I've also had a discussion, like the new things we're finding about the importance of post-menopause women taking not just calcium, because you can't use calcium. There's a lot of calcium we can't use in the body. But the importance of being on hormone therapy. It's in that same category of knowledge. We haven't tested women until the last 2 decades to know anything about them.
I know when I had my son 8 years ago, there was a woman that was running, and she was having to go on fertility pills and stuff. I'm like, well, now there seems a real conflict to me.
Right. The other thing.